Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here on the Sunday morning wake-up call. That's us. That's here. I'm Rick Moore. Our guest this morning is Tim Hafey, founder and board chair of the Fountain Fund. How are you?
Good. Thanks, Rick. Good morning.
Let's give a shout out to Erica Vixelio.
Yeah.
Right?
Erica is the executive director of the Fountain Fund, was going to join me today, but unfortunately her parents have had some health issues and she is with them at the hospital, so we certainly wish them well and a speedy recovery.
I was hoping to have her here with us as well, but obviously your parents are crucial.
Absolutely.
To our lives, and we need to be there with them.
Yep.
When they need us most. So I have faith that you can do all the work.
I'll try my best.
You do all the dirty work for the Fountain Fund here at the Sunday morning wake-up call. So the Fountain Fund, I have the notes here as improving the lives of the formerly incarcerated through lending, financial education, and community support.
Right.
For 3 years now?
We've been in business, yes, for about 3 years, and have about 85 clients, all formerly incarcerated, to whom we have given loans, low-interest loans, that they have used to pay back court-imposed debt, which has very debilitating consequences, including the suspension of one's driver's license. But they also use the funds to purchase job-related clothing or equipment, and some of them have even started small businesses.
I'm curious, so there seems to be a single story that gets you started. I mean, everybody says, how did you get started? What prompted you to get started? There's always the one.
Right.
Yeah, can you tell us that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I spent most of my career, Rick, as a federal prosecutor, including 5.5 years as the United States attorney for this district.
The prosecutor, the guy on the Perry Mason story kind of thing?
Not quite as dramatic, but yes, I was a person standing up in court every day arguing that people should go to prison.
You're here on Sunday morning wake-up call where there is no TV camera, wearing your church clothes. You have your long sleeve shirt on.
I do.
Full sleeves, tied, button, wearing your tie.
Yeah.
Long sleeve shirt all the way down and buttoned.
Thank you. I'm dressed for the occasion. So I was a former federal prosecutor a few years ago. I had stepped away from my appointment as U.S. attorney toward the end of the Obama administration. And I was working as a lawyer in private practice, just representing individuals and companies in white-collar criminal defense matters, when I had kind of a random encounter, a chance encounter with a person at a local business here in Charlottesville. I went to get a U-Haul truck because I was doing some, we were doing some work at our house. And I got to the counter of the business, and they said, this guy has your keys out on the lot. Went out to the lot. This man comes up to me. Here you go, Mr. Hafey. Here are your keys. And I said, you must be the guy they mentioned inside. And he said, you don't remember me? And I said, I'm sorry, sir. I don't recognize you. Tell me your name. He told me his name. And it turns out he had been a defendant in a criminal case that I had handled personally as an assistant U.S. attorney almost 10 years before. He had pled guilty to a federal drug offense. He'd gotten a 10-year sentence. He'd served 8.5 years. And he had recently returned to Charlottesville after serving that sentence. And we just started talking. We just spent 45 minutes just right there in the U-Haul lot talking about the challenges that he faced as a returning citizen with this federal felony conviction on his record. And he said the biggest obstacle was money, was debt. He owed hundreds of dollars to several local court systems. His child support had accrued over the time that he was incarcerated. The meter didn't stop running. He owed all of that money. And as a result of the debt that he faced, his driver's license was suspended as a matter of law. He was in violation of the terms of his supervised release because of the debt, which meant he couldn't get food stamps or disability or Section 8 housing assistance, all of these federal benefits to which he was otherwise entitled. So strictly by virtue of the fact that he was poor, he had all of these legal consequences beyond his sentence, right? He'd served his time, and he had these debilitating financial consequences. And I just, after that encounter, started thinking, you know, that's not fair, and what can we as a community do to boost people like this man who wants to do the right thing? He's working in this minimum wage job. He wants to pay his bills. He wants to support his kids. He just needs help getting to the starting line. And that was sort of the genesis of the idea for the Fountain Fund.
Again, our guest this morning is Tim Hafey. He's the founder and the board chairman for the Fountain Fund here in Charlottesville. But you reach further than just the city of Charlottesville or the county of Albemarle. Where else do you go?
We have some clients in the Shenandoah Valley in Harrisonburg. We have a few in Roanoke. We've even experimented with some loans farther away if we have partner organizations that send us clients. We get a lot of people referred to us from various places around the state. And while we're trying to build the model and understand how this process should work, our goal, Rick, is to expand this more broadly as we go forward. It should be available statewide, and we even envision some fountain funds, you know, springing up in other parts of the country.
You use the word, the title, the name is Fountain Fund. What does that mean? I mean, I'm not sure what image I'm supposed to get in my head with Fountain Fund.
It's got a couple of different meanings. The image of a fountain as a source of refreshment and sustenance was intentional. We wanted this to be a place where our clients can get refreshed or rejuvenated. But it also refers to, I heard an interview around the time that we were starting the Fountain Fund, I think it was on NPR, that had a recording of a former slave from Charlottesville. His name was Fountain Hughes. And there was an actual recording of an interview that had been done with Mr. Hughes in the 40s or 50s, where he was speaking very eloquently about the fact that he never wanted to have debt when he was freed because he had been property. And there's this really stirring snippet of this interview where he talks about how if he wanted a shirt, he ensured he saved the money to buy the shirt. He never wanted to be in debt because of his sort of legacy as a slave. And that was really moving to us. And so the name is also sort of a reference to Fountain Hughes, who was actually from Charlottesville, was a freed former slave.
8 minutes after the hour here with our guest today, Tim Hafey, talking about the Fountain Fund. I'm curious, so the number of prisoners released that might qualify for the Fountain Fund, is this every prisoner or is this some prisoners?
Yeah, we very intentionally, Rick, decided that we were not going to limit availability of these loans to any category of ex-offender. We weren't going to limit it to certain kinds of crime or length of sentence. The only requirement is that someone has been court involved. They don't even need to have spent a day in prison. If they had a criminal charge that was adjudicated guilty of any nature, then they're eligible for our service. And we have some who have been convicted of sex offenses or violent crimes. We have some that were convicted strictly of driving on a suspended license or financial crimes. So there is no disqualifying category of conviction, only formerly incarcerated. If there are lots of people that could use this that are just indigent or have other needs, but we have decided to make our loans available only to people that that have been court involved.
The feedback that you've gotten, all positive? when you decided that you were going to help folks with sex offender crimes? Did you get negative feedback?
Not directly, no. I've not heard anybody object to that. My fear is that some people see what we're doing and say, well, we don't need to change the rules. There are places available for people to get help, so let's just keep churning the wheels of the system as is. And that's 180 degrees opposite of what I think is wise policy, right? We are here to help people in the short term, but our long-term goal is to change the rules or generate data that will change the rules so that people aren't in this place to begin with. If the rules change and we don't criminalize poverty in this country by stacking these onerous fines on top of the consequences of incarceration, then people wouldn't need to come to us. They wouldn't have the fines and fees in the first place.
So when we talk about these individuals that you're helping, what's the proper phrase?
We call them client partners.
Client partners.
They're sort of clients because we're sort of like a bank, but they're partners because we give them a lot more than just the money. We give them financial literacy counseling and kind of partnership, mentorship. So we see them as partners. We also want them to become active mentors for others and bring us other client partners.
And what's the proper word for folks before they come become your partners?
Yeah, they're applicants. They're in our process. We try to look at everybody who comes to us as a potential client partner, whether we give them a loan or not. We want to help direct them to other services, help them assess what their needs are. We've helped a lot of people beyond the 85 or so in whom we've invested with a loan by identifying other options that they may have, referring them to partner organizations. Sometimes it's as simple as just helping them get a handle on how much money they owe and to what court. And they can then get into a payment plan or have other options in terms of getting back on their feet.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the changes that have happened. Because I want to talk about more than just Fountain Fund.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty to talk about with Fountain Fund for the hour, and we can skip back and forth throughout the hour. But one of the big changes that happened, you said that one of the concerns was that if you were helping client partners, creating client partners, mm-hmm. that maybe none of the rules would be changed.
Right.
Again, we are talking with Tim Hafey, who's the founder and the board chairman for the Fountain Fund here during the hour, Sunday morning wake-up call, that if you were creating client partners, that maybe none of the rules would be changed.
Right.
But here during 2019, the Virginia legislature did change some of the rules, correct?
They changed one rule temporarily, yes. And that's a good thing, but it's not a permanent thing, and in my view, it doesn't go far enough.
So those of us who are reading the newspaper and having the news spoken to us on the radio news or headlines and first paragraph, as I often tell people, you have to read more than the first paragraph.
You do.
Maybe we didn't understand it all the way.
Yeah, let me explain what happened and what didn't happen. So for years in the General Assembly, there have been efforts to change the rule that requires the suspension of a driver's license strictly for the failure to pay court-imposed debt, right? The law in Virginia has been, if you owe money to a court system, and there are all these mandatory fees and fines that apply, you can't have your driver's license. It's suspended. It's meant to be, as a matter of policy, an incentive for people to pay back the debt. The General Assembly, for years, has considered a bill to change that, and it's not gotten out of the House Courts of Justice Committee, which is chaired by Rob Bell, who's a representative from here locally in Charlottesville. It hasn't even gotten a vote on the floor of the House of Delegates because the committee has not passed it. The governor this year, Governor Northam, decided to insert a change in that policy, the mandatory suspension strictly for nonpayment of court-imposed debt. He inserted into his budget a provision that would repeal that or would change that, would essentially fund about the amount of revenue that generates every year. And that then, along with the rest of the budget, went to the floor of the House of Delegates. It skipped over the committee process, and the entire House voted on it. And it passed overwhelmingly with bipartisan support. But what that means, Rick, is that for only this two-year budget cycle, that rule, the mandatory suspension, does not apply. Now, it goes into effect July 1st, and it's only in effect for the 2 years of this budget because it's tied to this particular budget that was passed by the General Assembly. Now, that will create more of an impetus to get this back in front of the General Assembly through its regular legislative process. And ideally, since it passed overwhelmingly as part of the budget process, it gets a full vote and it becomes a permanent change. But to be honest, to be clear, right now, it only applies for 2 years. It goes into effect July 1st, and it isn't as if everybody immediately gets their license back in the mail. Every person who's in this category, whose license has been suspended because of debt, has to go to DMV, has to apply, has to go through a process to get their license reinstated. The fines don't go away, right? The fines still exist. So people that go get their license back, they're still going to owe $3,000 or $4,000, whatever
it is. All the money from till whenever up through up until 2019?
Well, no, the fines continue to be operational. The only thing that's changed is that your license isn't suspended because of your inability to pay. You still owe the money, but your license is not going to be suspended just because you can't pay. And that gets to what really needs to happen, right? It is unreasonable in my view, and I'm a career prosecutor. I spent a lot of time on the government side working to hold people accountable for crimes. And when you impose a $300 fine per count of felony conviction in Virginia, regardless of ability to pay, that has no connection, in my view, to criminal justice policy that keeps anybody safe. It's not a deterrent because it's unrealistic that individuals who are poor can pay that. It might as well be $3,000 or $30,000 for a lot of people that go through the system. So why do we stack as a matter of law, as a mandatory fine? The judge has no discretion. Person comes before him who's homeless. He owes $300 for every single count for which he's convicted. A millionaire comes in front of him. He owes $300. That, to me, is bad policy. And that's what we need to change. So it's great that we've pulled back temporarily on the mandatory suspension, but we're not going to get real change unless we pull back on the mandatory fees and fines and costs. That is the underlying driver of this criminalization of poverty that we're trying to work on at the Fountain Fund.
Again, our guest today, Tim Hafey, founder and board chair from the Fountain Fund. So at what point or how do you think that the judges will stop adding on the fines?
Well, the judges have no choice. That's part of the problem.
Those are required fees?
Mandatory,
and fines?
Yes. Mandatory. There are a lot of, in Virginia law, mandatory imposition of criminal fees and fines.
I thought you said that those were, I must have misunderstood then, but I thought you said they were, so tell me that again. Continue.
There are, as a matter of law in Virginia, there are dozens of mandatory fines that operate regardless of a defendant's ability to pay. The big one is $300 per count of conviction, right? If you are convicted of petty larceny, or if you're convicted of DUI, or if you're convicted of aggravated assault, for every single count of conviction, the law requires a fine of $300 to be imposed. If you're convicted of five counts, that's five times 300, $1,500. And that, Rick, operates regardless of whether you have no money, right? You come into the system poor, or if you have a lot of money and you come into the system with some means. That is a blunt instrument that is designed to add deterrence, and I just don't think it does. It's crazy to me that judges don't have the ability to apportion punishment according to means. It's not a deterrent to put a fine on somebody that is unrealistic in terms of their ability to pay. So that's where we need to work on giving judges more discretion to tailor outcomes and justice to individual circumstances as opposed to a broad and over-inclusive mandatory fine.
And the method to do that is to have the legislature remove that
yes.
law so that the judges do not have to
exactly.
add that.
Yes, if the legislature were to make a lot of these fines discretionary and give the judge the ability to impose it in the appropriate case, if he or she thinks that it will create a deterrent or will reflect the magnitude of the offense, that makes sense to me, right? Because, again, in the criminal justice system, you want the outcome to be maximally efficient and tailored to the individual circumstances of the person and the victim who come before the judge. When you impose mandatory rules that apply regardless of those circumstances, to me, that's over-inclusive.
All right. We'll be right back with Tim Hafey from the Fountain Fund. All right. Back in the studio here on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call with Tim Hafey. We were talking about, Tim, what needs to happen at the legislature in making some of those laws discretionary for the judges. Does the Fountain Fund do any sort of work with that and getting the legislature to make those changes?
Yeah, well, we're a 501c3 tax-exempt organization, which means we can't directly lobby in support of or against any particular piece of legislation. But what we can do and what we intend to do is generate data that could inform policy decisions. Right now, we have a lot of really positive feel-good stories, right? I could tell you about a lot of our client partners who've gotten loans, who have become a manager or foreperson at their job and had their income double and have then sent us other clients. Like, we got a lot of great anecdotal evidence that this works. When you remove this debt and these consequences, great things happen. People become productive. But the next step is to quantify that in measure outcomes. And if we can generate data that shows without these financial burdens, people go back to prison less, right? Recidivism drops and productivity increases and you're creating tax-paying citizens. Ideally, that rational evidence that the removal of these collateral consequences actually result in better outcomes hopefully will influence the debate. As I said, this is going to be in the General Assembly because of the budget amendment during the next 2 years. And we want to provide that kind of information to delegates really on both sides of the issue to show them that when you remove these barriers, positive things happen. That's good for everybody. That's not just good for the individual client partners, the men and women who are formerly incarcerated. That's good for all of us. We collectively in communities should be invested in the success of even the poorest, the most indigent among us, right? When they are uplifted and they become productive, that's good for all of us. That's better outcomes. That's less tax dollars. That's more people working. That's good, right? So we have to convince people that we should all be invested in this, not as a matter of charity, but as a matter of sort of mutual benefit.
Well, you know, there's going to be a new governor next time around.
Yeah.
Are you concerned that that makes a difference, who your new governor might be, regardless of which party they might be from?
Yeah, I mean, look, the elections have consequences. We've seen that at the state, at the local, at the state, and the federal level, that policy changes, right? I was a U.S. attorney in the Obama years, and a lot of the policies that we put in place in the Justice Department have been reversed by the Trump Sessions now Barr Justice Department. And to me, that's a bad thing. Same thing could happen at the state level. Who is elected governor, who's elected to the General Assembly, has a direct impact on the ability to change these rules. So absolutely, people should, in my view, pay attention to this issue, to issues of criminal justice reform, and that hopefully will inform their votes for people at all levels of government.
I'm curious, how do you decide who gets your aid?
We have a pretty elaborate process where people come in and they give us a lot of information. The information has to do both sort of looking backward at where they've been, what they've done, but also looking forward at what they intend to do, how they would use the money. And they sit with our staff. We have a three-person staff, three people that do this full-time, and they do actually sit down and map out sort of a budget and how they would what their needs are and how our loan would fit into that. We have sort of an objective rating system that spits out sort of a recommended outcome. it's not dispositive. It's just meant to be sort of a starting point. And then we have a loan committee that is certain members of our board of directors, and then a couple of other people from the community, several of whom are themselves formerly incarcerated, and they evaluate these. They try to apply an objective standard. Sometimes we say, yes, great candidate. This person deserves a loan. They become a client partner. Sometimes we say, you know what? We have concerns about ability to repay, reliability. No. Sometimes we say, not yet. Like, you need to do the following few things and come back to us in 60 days or 90 days. We try to look at everybody who comes to us as a potential client partner, even if they're not yet ready. So that's the process that we use, that we've honed over, you know, 2 years or so of making these loans.
How does somebody move beyond not yet?
Well, there are people that come to us, let's say they've had a job for 30 days and it's going great, and their boss is willing to step up and say, she's a fantastic employee and she would really benefit from a loan because I'd give her more hours. We may say, that's a good start, but we want to see a little bit more of a track record. So come back to us in 60 days when you've continued in this situation, and we'll reevaluate. Sometimes people have discrete things that they need to pay off before they come to us, consumer debt or other debt, or we want them to get on a payment plan with a particular court. So there are times when an individual circumstance suggests potential, but we just want to see a few more things before we make the decision, yes, this is a client partner in whom we're ready to work.
And you've had, you said, 85 client partners?
Yes.
How has that grown in the course of 3 years? I mean, how many did you have in year one versus year two versus year three?
Yeah, it's grown dramatically because our process has gotten better. You know, when we first started doing this, we didn't really have much of a process. You know, we devised an intake form, and we got some information, generally self-reported information, from our applicants. As we've gone forward, we've just gotten smarter and gotten better, and we know now more what the indicators are of potential success. So as our process has gotten more efficient, we've been able to make more loans. We're now, you know, the loan committee meets every 2 weeks, and every 2 weeks we have a handful, 4, 5, 6 client partners that we are considering. So our pace has accelerated. So is our fundraising. I mean, some of this is a function of money. You know, as we have gone forward, we've been really fortunate that we live in a generous community, and people have stepped up and been financially supportive, and that has given us a pool of money that has grown that allows us to accelerate the pace of loans.
Have you been 100% successful in repayments?
No, we have not. There have been a few of our client partners who have gotten reincarcerated. There are a few, unfortunately, that have just dropped out of sight, and we are about to pursue collections, obtaining a judgment against, for the first time, just a small number of our client partners with whom we have lost touch. So no, it's not 100%. You know, this is our client partners. It's a risky population in terms of, couldn't go to a bank and get regular financing for a small business or for a personal loan. And we know that going in. These are people we want, frankly, people that are risky. We want to make an impact.
Right.
But that means we're going to have a default rate. And I don't know where that lands. Is that going to be at 10% or 20% or 30%? But we went into this knowing that there would be a default rate and trying to plan for that. And that's okay with me. If we didn't have a default rate, it would mean we weren't taking enough risk. We don't just want to give money to people that could make it otherwise. Right, rearrange the furniture of their financial life.
Have you changed your application?
We haven't changed the application, but we've probably gotten a little bit more risk tolerant. I think we have reached to give loans to some people that maybe in the beginning we were a little more cautious about and would have said no. Now we're willing to say yes, even if there are indicators of risk. And that's part of the learning process. We sort of need to do some trial and error to really refine our process. And we're getting better. I just think we're getting smarter about this as we go forward.
30 minutes after the hour, as we're talking about the Fountain Fund with our guest today, Tim Hafey, founder and board chairman over there. And a shout out to Erica Vixilio.
Right.
I've got that spelled out in the proper term, and yeah. I don't know why that's catching me off. Erica, shout out to you and your family today. Other than repaying the loan, are these folks required to do other things for you? Do they do community service?
No.
Do they help the Fountain Fund in any way?
We want them to become mentors to others, right? We've gotten a lot of client partners who have been referred to us by other client partners. And what we have found is that when there is a network of support beyond the money for people, they're more likely to be successful. We also have, we do sometimes require credit counseling or personal budgeting, right? Like there are times where people come to us and they've never had a bank account or they've never had to balance a checkbook. So there are times where we condition the granting of a loan on sitting down with our staff or even a partner organization and getting some of that basic personal finance curriculum. But no, we don't require community service or anything beyond things that will help them be able to pay back the loan.
Has the community or the board talked about ways that may help the client partners? I mean, is all that they need to do is present their application and reach the level that's necessary, and then take their what's the loan dollar?
There's no minimum or maximum. Generally, I think our average loan is between $2,000 and $3,000.
And that's to pay their debt to get their driver's license?
That's the vast majority of them, Rick. Most of our client partners over the last 2 years have come to us and they owe, you know, $600 to Albemarle County Circuit Court, and they owe $400 to Fluvanna, and they owe this much in back child support. We pay those debts off directly, right? Our money goes to the court system or to child support enforcement. They then incur an obligation to pay us, the Fountain Fund, back at a 5% interest rate over 2 or 3 or 4 years. So that often results in, since the courts have been paid, they can get their license back. Now they got to pay a reinstatement fee. And there are all these collateral fines that I didn't know existed, right? I've worked in the criminal justice system for 20 years. I had no idea how many mandatory, not discretionary, mandatory fees and fines and interest payments are added on top of the basic core financial obligation. We clear that for them, and then they get their often get their license back, which means they can get around town easier. They can go to extra shifts at the job. They can, some of them have actually become sort of in management in their construction firm or their restaurant where they work, right? So we are helping them just get to the starting line of being able to get around town easier. And that then unleashes their productivity and their desire to be successful.
Tell me one of these. I want to get for this last, during the last half hour, I want to tell me some of these success stories. So start off now by telling me one of the success stories.
One of our very first clients was working locally in construction. He had was in his 40s, I think. And his boss loved him, said that he was one of the most reliable workers. He was getting a ride to the job site somewhere here in Charlottesville from his girlfriend. We gave him a loan, which allowed him to pay back his fees and fines and costs and get his driver's license. His boss then immediately made him the foreperson of another job site in Petersburg, Virginia, and gave him a truck, gave him a company vehicle that he could use every day to drive from his home in Charlottesville to Petersburg, where he was the boss. So here's a guy that was working very hard, getting a ride to work every day, who once he had his driver's license, his boss felt so strongly about his potential that he gave him a company vehicle and made him the supervisor of another construction site an hour and a half away. And he now is making so much more money, and he has sent us several other clients, men that work with him on this construction site. So there are people like that who are ready to fly, and they just can't get out of the, you know, they can't get off the perch from which they could fly because of this debt. And when we clear that away and just get them just to point A, then they have really thrived, and that's really, really exciting. The only other story I will tell you reinforces it. It's not just about money, but it's about confidence, right? I remember one particular client partner back in the beginning, we decided to give her a loan, and she was not from Charlottesville. She was, I believe she was from Roanoke, and she came here because we were having kind of an event, and we invited her, and I told her at this event that we had decided to give her a loan, and she started crying, and she hugged me, and she said, "No one has ever believed in me before." And I realized, you know, she was somebody that no bank, right, no judge had given a break. And our collective investment in her, right, our belief in her ability to succeed had a benefit beyond the money, right? It had a benefit in terms of how she sees herself. And we've seen that again and again. There's an intangible benefit that our client partners get from people like me, right, investing in them. And that psychic benefit or that intangible sense of, man, all right, people do believe that I'm capable of paying back this loan, that has a ripple effect in terms of building self-esteem and confidence. So I think we're doing that as much. That's as important as the financial support we're giving.
So that person was a female.
Yeah.
Do you have a lot of male versus female in the Fountain Fund?
Yeah, I don't know the current numbers of the 85. I think about 2/3 are male, 1/3 are female. I think most are live in more urban environments, but some rural. We have white, African American, Latino clients. Right, we have a pretty diverse spectrum and the counts of conviction are also very diverse. So that hasn't been something that's been an explicit priority, but there are a lot of people in this situation. Who live in small towns, who live in big cities, who are black or white or Latino, who have had small crimes and had big crimes. There's so many people that share this common need for investment, for capital, for access to financial support. And that's what we've seen over the last 2 years.
Is there any, I don't know how to, I guess I'll just phrase it in this two-word phrase, it may be overly done, is there financial counseling? I mean, you give them this money, you pay off their debts,
yeah,
and then they're out there to move and work. But now, maybe they're in a position that they haven't been in before.
Right.
Do they need financial counseling to pay their bills where they've... Have they ever been at a zero point?
Yeah. Yes. The answer to that is absolutely yes. And it depends, right? There are some people, for instance, our small business clients who are pretty savvy financially, and we've given them loans that they've used to buy some equipment that they use to start a garage or to start a landscaping business. They are less rudimentary in terms of their need for financial counseling. We have other client partners who, as you said, Rick, have really never been in a situation where they have to pay bills, pay rent. We spend a lot of time with them, sitting down, literally going over their expenses, going over their incomes. How is our loan going to fit into that? And giving them really sort of, here is how you should structure your life, financial counseling. Our staff does that really, really effectively.
All right. Again, our guest today, Tim Hafey, from the Fountain Fund. You can find them at fountainfund.org. How do you get, you said that the area around here provide you with a lot of donations.
Mm-hmm.
How is that?
Yeah, we raise money. I mean, that's one of the primary obligations that I have and the other members of the board have is to raise money. Most of it has come from individuals here in the Charlottesville area.
There's people writing you checks, or do you have, silent auctions, or what do you do?
People write us checks, sometimes fairly large checks, which has been really reaffirming. We're about to enter a phase of doing some foundation fundraising and corporate giving, right? We're hopeful that we will compete for money in the criminal justice reform community where big foundations who see what we're doing and see it as a model for others will invest in us and help us grow. There are also a lot of corporations, particularly financial institutions, the Wells Fargo's, the Bank of America's, who do give a lot of money to organizations that create banking customers. So we're hopeful that some of them will invest in us as well. That's the next frontier in terms of fundraising, is to shift from wealthy people here locally to corporate giving and big foundation support.
All right. Come back. I want to talk about Florida.
Sure.
All right. Be right back. All right. Back with our guest, Tim Hafey. Tim, there was a lot of work done in Florida in the last 4 or 5 months. I guess it started in November of 2018, a big vote where the citizens passed Amendment 4, restoring the right to vote to all individuals, quote, who have completed all terms of their sentence.
Right.
Right? But then again, just this past month or this month, Florida legislature, I'm not going to get this right, but then the legislature went and made sure that those folks who'd been to prison had to pay back their fines first.
Right. Conditioned the restoration of rights on the repayment of court-imposed debt.
Exactly. Right. So all the citizens said, hey, we want people who'd been to prison, they have their right to vote.
Yeah.
And then the Republican-controlled legislature said, right, yeah, you can vote, but you have to pay back your fines first, which the Fountain Fund is sort of saying can cost a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a lot of interesting has a lot of interesting things about Florida and its parallels to what's going on here. Right. In Virginia, we also had an attempt by Governor McAuliffe to restore via executive order all restoration of rights to vote for people who had already served their prison sentences and completed any period of probation or supervised release. Governor McAuliffe said when he was governor, I'm just going to do that as a matter of executive order. The Supreme Court of Virginia said it can't be done categorically. It has to be done individually. In other words, you have the power as the governor to restore someone's rights after they have completed their period of incarceration. But you have to do that person by person. So toward the end of the McAuliffe administration, they reviewed actually the individual circumstance of 200,000 or so men and women in Virginia who were in this category, right? They'd served time in prison and whatever period of supervision was done. And they restored the vast majority of them back to vote. In Florida, the legislature immediately said, we're just going to do that. We're going to say, you don't have to apply. You're eligible to vote if you've completed your sentence and any period of probation. Then the Republican General Assembly there in Florida said, well, there's one more condition that we're going to impose, and that's you have to pay everything back. And that gets us into the situation that we were discussing earlier, where a lot of these people, these were fines that were imposed as a matter of law, mandatory, not tied to their ability to pay. They don't have the money to pay it. So they are not only prevented from getting a driver's license like in Virginia, but they're prevented from voting. But Florida is a conservative state that has actually passed some smart criminal justice reforms. So has Kentucky, so has Georgia, so has North Carolina, right? There are Texas. There are conservative legislators, Republican legislatures around the country that have methodically pulled back on mandatory sentences, reinvested some of the savings in treatment and prevention programs, and seen spending decline, correctional spending decline, and recidivism decline. Texas is the great example. Under Governor Perry, a Republican governor, current cabinet secretary to President Trump, their Republican legislature pulled back on mandatory sentencing for drug offenders, and that saved money, and they reinvested that money in treatment programs, drug courts, and programs that helped people who were arrested for drug offenses address the underlying cause of that offense, which was addiction. They spend less money on jails and prisons and enforcement. They have fewer people returning to prison, right? That's a Republican-led effort. It's happening all over the country, but not in Virginia. For whatever reason, in Virginia, it's like our politics are in 1985, where we have sort of tough-talking prosecutors in the General Assembly who say, this is a deterrence. Let's impose these heavy financial consequences. That'll prevent people from breaking the law in the first place. That's just wrong. And we have progressive Democrats who say, no, we have to forgive people and we have to give people second chances, right? It's like we're stuck in an old school paradigm when there's data from around the country, from places like Texas, that everybody wins when we reinvest in treatment and prevention and not so much in incarceration. I hope we get to that point in Virginia, because again, this is not a Democratic or Republican thing. This is a good policy thing, and there are a lot of Republicans who believe this around the country. But for whatever reason, it hasn't come to Richmond.
Would the Fountain Fund ever reach outside of the state? Would you reach to Florida and offer money to a client partner down there?
Absolutely, yes. Look, I will tell you that I always hesitate to make predictions, particularly audacious ones. But our goal, Rick, is to have fountain funds all over the country someday. We think that this is not a Charlottesville unique situation, right? There are people in this position who can't drive or can't maximize potential because of court-imposed debt everywhere in this country. We've had a lot of inquiries from people around the country. We've been trying to perfect the model locally. And Charlottesville is a very rich community because we have a lot of partner organizations that help with other services, right? We don't do job counseling. We don't do housing. We don't do mental health or substance abuse. We have partners in Charlottesville that work with our client partners to get that done. So this wouldn't work everywhere. You need those other partners for this to be successful. But maybe it would be successful in Detroit or in Florida or in Oakland, California. And our goal someday, as we perfect the model, as we raise money, particularly foundation and corporate money, is to expand this around Virginia first, but ultimately in other places. Maybe in Virginia, the law changes. The General Assembly makes this budget amendment permanent, but that hasn't happened in Tennessee. So the next frontier is Fountain Fund Nashville or Memphis. I don't know, but we are not content to have this be a nice local charity. We want this to be something with national impact, and that's going to take data collection, outcome measurement, and it's going to take money.
I have this image of going down to Florida and making some Republican Floridians in the legislature very unhappy, though. Do you have an image of that?
Well, as I said before, my fear is that some of those people will see this as, we don't need to change the rule because there are plenty of good people in the community that will step forward and provide resources. We don't want to be so successful that we suggest that there isn't a need to change the rules.
Right. We don't need to stop the homeless because there's people bringing food to them.
Exactly. That to me is wrong-headed. Right. There shouldn't be a need to bring them food in the first place. We ought to be teaching them to farm and to cook, right? To use your analogy. Same thing here. It shouldn't be necessary for a fountain fund to pay back court-imposed debt. If the court-imposed debt itself in the first place is wrong or is unreasonable or is ineffective to achieve any kind of public safety outcome. So we want to work by generating data on changing the underlying rules. That doesn't mean we'll go out of business. We would still, that means we'd have more money for small business or for people to use our money to do other things that will make them productive. It's not like our service is tied exclusively to the repayment of these mandatory fines. Just think how much more impact we could have if we're investing in entrepreneurs and not just people paying back their debt. That's what we're trying to get to. And it's tricky because, again, we're a 501c3. We can't go to the General Assembly and say, vote for this bill. But we can contribute to the policy discussion about the underlying issue.
Curious, do you have another story of success that you can tell?
I have lots of stories of success, so many. We have a client partner who has served exclusively time for failure to pay a child support and driving with a suspended license. That's it, right? Never a crime against another person, but his entire criminal record was a function of poverty. His most recent driving while suspended was to drive to medical appointments because he was suffering from cancer. He was going to get chemotherapy and needed to get to his chemo. So he drove and he got stopped and he was driving on a suspended license, right? We have been able to take him, again, this is a person whose only crime was being poor, get him his loans and fines and fees repaid, to get him into a vehicle so he can get to his medical appointments. His medical situation is dramatically improved, and he's working full-time, and he's sending us other clients. There are just dozens of people like him who just want to play by the rules, right? Just want to do the right thing, just want to get around town and be responsible, who have been prevented from doing that. And finding people like that is really, really exciting.
I'm curious, if you have someone out, again, our guest today is Tim Hafey, who's the founder and the board chairman for the Fountain Fund. Is there a special difficulty in helping anyone who is homeless? Because I know that there are tricks with a homeless person finding, you know, it's difficult finding a homeless person finding a job because they don't have a steady address yeah. that they can list, and then et cetera. So I can see yeah. you're nodding your head. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, we have a partnership with The Haven. You know, we have a lot of partnerships with organizations around the community, and The Haven is a steady source of referrals to us. What would generally happen, Rick, if someone came to us while homeless, was that we would get them to The Haven or other places to help address that core need first. You need a stable residence. You need a roof over your head that you can afford. Let's take care of that first with the help of the partner organization, and then we'll talk about a loan, right? That's a good example of the kind of situation that might merit waiting before we're ready to invest. Because look, we are not a bank. This isn't a math problem. We don't evaluate people strictly.
Right. We talked about that earlier. It's a loan, not a grant.
It's not a grant. It's a loan. And so we're evaluating ability to repay. And somebody that doesn't have a fixed address or a job or a potential to get a job, for that matter, is more of a risk. So again, people like that, we try to help them get those things in place before we consider a loan. So we don't turn them away. We try to get them on their feet, so to speak, so that they're ready to get a loan. Not everybody who comes to us is ready. We can give them a loan and it won't work because they don't have these other things, these other building blocks in place. So by reaching out to us, we get them to other sources of assistance. And ideally, once they have those building blocks in place, then they come to us with loan readiness.
I'm curious. So we talked about Virginia. We've talked about Florida. You mentioned Texas,
yeah.
North Carolina, and other southern states. Have we seen anything like this in California, which is notorious for having a large amount of homeless folks,
yeah.
but is also known for having a modern set of laws to help people, mm-hmm. or similar states? Do you have anybody else out there like the Fountain Fund?
Yes, no, not precisely. We looked very hard for another organization that does what we do, and we didn't find anyone who's doing this strictly for the formerly incarcerated. But your question about California is a good one, because just a couple of weeks ago, I moderated a panel at the Tom Tom Festival called Second Chance Cities, What Are Our Communities Doing to Help the Formerly Incarcerated? And one of the panelists in that discussion was Jose Cisneros, who is the treasurer of San Francisco, the elected treasurer. And he, since he's been treasurer, and he's been in that job for over 10 years, he has actually gotten his city council to rescind a lot of those mandatory fees and fines that are imposed. Right? So here's a government official who has done what I think we need to do in Virginia, changed the rules so that people aren't slapped with these municipally imposed fines and in the situation in the first place. The other significant thing that's happened in the last 5 or 6 years was the Ferguson, Missouri report, right? Ferguson was the place where there was a police shooting where Michael Brown was shot by a police officer.
Got it.
Big protests. So the Justice Department, the Obama Justice Department, where I worked, went in and did a really deep dive, the Civil Rights Division, of the policing situation in Ferguson. And what they found was that there was a real policing for profit motive in Ferguson, that the police were writing a lot of tickets and targeting the collection of money as a policy goal. And that fell disproportionately on poor people and was a, the Justice Department said, that's bad policy, right? You're going to end up with the wrong people who can't really pay, who get these fees and fines, and then all the collateral consequences that ensue. And the Ferguson report was sort of a light bulb moment for a lot of people about the policy of policing for profit. Maybe we should change that. It's been a model that others have held up around the country as let's not be in that situation. So that's encouraging. I think there's a consensus starting to form that this doesn't work.
So just a few minutes left as we talk about the Fountain Fund. You can go to the website, www.fountainfund.org. Our guest, Tim Hafey, founder and the board chairman. What are the goals? 3 years, correct?
Yeah.
So you've got to have a 1 year, 5 year, 10 year plan.
Yep.
So, right? So give us some short term and some long term.
Short term is continue to identify people in our Central Virginia community who need loans and invest in them. Secondary, let's expand into other areas. Let's make our services more widely available. And then I guess the third phase and the harder one is let's gather information. Let's put in place a system of outcome measurement that will generate empirical evidence that this works, that when you remove these barriers, people achieve much better outcomes. And let's use that around the country to inform policy efforts.
So you must have found already that things are working, mm-hmm. right? Because you've got success stories. It sounded like when you were talking to me about some folks that weren't paying back, that it sounded like a relatively small percentage.
That's right.
But where do you go from here to, you know, to grow your system, mm-hmm. to grow your plan and keep it in that manner?
Yeah. We need more staff. We need more resources. We need Richmond, Northern Virginia, Tidewater, and ultimately Detroit and Oakland, right? It's just, it's a function of designing something that you're right, Rick. Now I think we think works. It's expanding it. It's making it larger, right? We have three staff. We have Erica, we have Paul Yates, and we have Carl Brown, who are the real driving force of this. But we need more Pauls and more Carls in other places, and we got to identify them.
That's tough.
It is tough. A lot of this comes down to people. We're fortunate that we have really good people who turn the wheels of our process. But there are other people out there in other places. We just have to go, we have to go find them, and we got to raise the money to pay them.
Yeah. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Because the Fountain Fund, as I did my homework on that, it blows you away to find out not just how incredible it is, but the incredible people that you find and that you assist.
Absolutely right. Our client partners are heroes. They're working really hard to be productive. And our staff are also facilitating that success. It's really exciting to see.
Well, thank you very much, Tim Hafey, for coming on for the hour.
Thank you.
All right. Adios, my friends. And we will see you next time.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.